Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the BuckleCast. This is Jason Rolson back with you. Happy to help you usher in opening day. I'll have my new boss, Dejan Kovacevic, joining the show, as well as your texts and voicemails from the up-and-running hotline. Oh, about that I just mentioned, I do have a new writing gig. I'll be writing a weekly analytical column on Mondays called Monday Mound Visit at dkpittsburghsports.com. DKPS has grown in leaps and bounds since DK first started the site in 2014. So I'm happy to join the crew along with John Parado, DK himself, and some others in bringing you what we hope will be some very intriguing Pittsburgh Pirates coverage for the 2019 season. Right now, you can give DKPS a try for 99 cents for the first month, and I guarantee you, you'll want to stick around and enjoy the coverage. I hope you'll give it a shot. Before we get going, I would like to remind you that the Pirates home opener is on April 1st, and that gives you plenty of time to visit the Pittsburgh Fan. The Pittsburgh Fan is your source for officially licensed Pirates merchandise. And did I mention it's right across the street from PNC Park? Every time I go to the PNC Park, I like to pop in there, see what's new in terms of memorabilia, cool stuff. They have stuff you won't see anywhere else. No knockoffs, all officially licensed stuff, as well as Pirates Guide 2019. Hey, give it a shot too. Right now, you can save 15% if you use the promo code BuckleCast, whether that's in-store or online. And they're online at thepittsburghfan.com. So again, use promo code BuckleCast for 15% off your order in-store or online. We'll get to your calls and texts in just a bit, but first let's start with Dejan Kovacevic. All right, so on the BuckleCast now we have a special guest. He's my new boss. He's Dejan Kovacevic of dkpittsburghsports.com. Dejan, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, man, I hate that term. Did you have to use boss? Come on, man.
All I've
ever felt like in this gig, seriously, is all I've ever felt like is just a reporter among other reporters. That's kind of the way we've treated it from day one. I can say here, since you brought it up, that we're happy to have you aboard. We're looking forward to what's going to be called the Monday Mound Visit.
Yep.
And intensive, I am told by you, all kinds of legitimately inside baseball stuff, unlike anything that we've had on the site, at least for baseball. We've had it for hockey. We've had it for football. And our baseball fans told us repeatedly they wanted something. We didn't have the right person, and now we do.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Check that out on Monday, April 1st. Will be the first edition. I hope I can live up to that. So, try the site for 99 cents. You can try the first month, and then I guarantee you'll be hooked, especially with what we're putting into the Pirates coverage. Myself, one of the best to ever do it around here, John Parado, and of course Dejan himself. So, no reason not to try it for 99 cents, so please do so. And Dejan, I wanted to start here because before, what I like to do when I have guys like you, established guys in the sports media around Pittsburgh, before we get into the team, I want to talk about your craft a little bit. Now, I'm sure a lot of my listeners will remember that you put in quite a bit of time on the beat back in, I think, 2005 through, I think, parts of 2011. You were the beat guy for the Post-Gazette. And the first thing I wanted to ask you when I knew I would have you on today is, how did those years, those 6 years or so, how did those years shape you in terms of how you might look at the actual game of baseball?
Well, the first thing they did was they aged me way more than 6 years. Baseball is unlike any beat, not just in sports, but really across journalism. It's funny that when I was at the Post-Gazette, this is a true thing, the union at the PG, and I believe this holds true to this day, has literally one exception in its entire handbook for all of the rules, meaning the guild contract, the collective bargaining agreement, where the baseball writer is exempt from everything, like meaning overtime, vacations, accrue, everything. There's a separate chapter that's just for the baseball writer because it's that demanding, it's that different. You're not getting days off when you're out in California on a 7-day trip. In a lot of ways, it was fun. It was exhilarating, which a lot of people probably roll their eyes at considering how bad the team was. At that time, that was, of course, in the 20-year losing streak, including a 105-loss gem in there in 2010. But how did it shape what I learned about baseball? Probably more than anything, I'd say it shaped what I learned a lot about sports, and I would trace that back to one specific story. My first year on the beat, Oliver Perez was coming off of his crazy successful season, just historic, his strikeout totals. PNC Park was just bouncing every time he took the mound. It was really probably unlike any pitching experience that's happened at that ballpark, the 1 year of Oliver looking crazy, like Sandy Koufax at times. And I went into, this was early the following season, into the assistant coaches area, and I asked Spin Williams, who was the pitching coach at the time, I don't remember the exact question, but it was something that I think I kind of wanted to make myself sound like I was some kind of expert, right? Because I was new on the beat, and I wanted to, you know, everybody, hey, look at me. I know baseball, right?
Yep.
And Spin Williams interrupts me, looks at me with one eyebrow up, and goes, son, if we're going to have a good working relationship here, you got to understand one thing. You don't know anything about pitching. Nobody who hasn't pitched knows anything about pitching. And the fact of the matter is, even if you have pitched and you're watching a game, there's really only two or three people in the entire stadium who know at any given time what's going on. So I'll make you a deal. When you want to know something, ask me a question. I'll be happy to answer it. And then I'll make you sound like an expert. I have passed that story on to reporters, our reporters, countless times, that there's always that measure of humility that you have to have no matter how much you think you know about a game or the game that's being covered, that you can always know more and that you can always learn more by asking that extra question. And I've applied that, Jason, I can't tell you how many times, whether it's baseball, football, hockey, or the Olympics, where you legitimately don't know what they're doing. And you have no choice but to ask. You know, one of the competitors, especially of the less prominent sports. I covered a badminton event once in London. And I can say, well, I played it in my backyard, but it's not the same, you know?
Right.
So I would say that more than anything, the baseball beat taught me that and how to just basically be humble as it came to reporting and making sure that you ask the right questions in order to make sure that the experts are actually the experts.
That's very good grounding advice. And I'll just say that I don't know what kind of badminton games you play, but mine get pretty competitive. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I did learn that shuttlecock was one word. So I had to find out all kinds of different things, including that the I'll have a badminton story from that event some other day if you're interested. It's fascinating, though, that these teams were actually trying to throw matches. It made for a great column because they wanted to avoid the Chinese in the next round. And eventually the IOC had to step in and ask why these teams were visibly out there in competition trying to throw matches, like unapologetically. And it flew in the face of what sport, singular, is supposed to be about. So that's my badminton story for another day.
I'm gonna book a time to hear that one because I'm really curious. But let's get back to it. So kind of stemming from that, because now, you know, of course you got off the beat, went to a columnist role, and then of course started the site. So now you cover games, and you do columns as well. But when you cover a game, like you will tomorrow at the season opener in Cincy, do you ever revert back to that beat mentality, or do you approach it, you know, more like a columnist first, or is it kind of a melding of the two, or how is your approach with that?
Well, I actually view it as that I never left the beat. I don't see it as a, you know, you did it for the newspaper and you had something stamped on your forehead at the time, and then you didn't. I've been covering the Pirates nonstop since 2005. I do as many games as most beat writers do, whether that's home or road. And when I, especially on the road, when it's usually just the one person, you are the beat person. I was just in Houston now for those two exhibition games. I wasn't sitting there pondering, you know, my opinions. I had to get news out.
Right.
So that part never really changes. Now, when we do multiple people on the road, which we began doing this past season with hockey just because of the extraordinary demand for coverage of the Penguins because they are what they are in our city, it's a little bit of a different dynamic. We do have a beat reporter there most often, and I'll just, you know, work on a column. But otherwise, I mean, you can talk to anybody who's done columns at a newspaper, and they'll tell you that they never lose that reporter's edge or that reporter's mindset when they're in the room or up in the press box. You're always thinking news first. So it's not like it's some big dramatic transition for me. And you're also, by the way, thinking about breaking news. I mean, you're thinking about, you know, that even within the scope of a column, this is one thing I'm particularly proud of, that, and I think that this having this independent site allowed me to do this that I never would have been able to pull off at newspapers, is I've always considered my columns to be something of a hybrid in that regard. I mean, there's opinion in there, but I'm also loading into them a lot of original, exclusive information. Almost all of the quotes and interviews that I get are one-on-ones that you're not going to see anywhere else. So it all ties together. Let's put it that way. I don't know if that answered your question.
Oh, no, it did. And the last thing you said there, okay, about how your approach now is kind of a melding of the two, like I really identify that. I think that's a modern beat reporting at its finest, really. So let's get into the 2019 Pirates now. I got to ask, what's your gut feeling on this team? Because every time I sit down and try to make some kind of educated prediction on something like, you know, a record or whatever, it seems like I talk myself in and out of at least 15 different scenarios.
Right. So, and why is that? I'll ask you that first. Why do you talk yourself in and out of scenarios when you're predicting the Pirates?
Because
I'll give you my answer. Let's not say that there's a right or wrong answer here. I'm just curious as to yours.
No, I like to exchange ideas here. So in my opinion, it's because, you know, obviously there is talent on this club, but other teams in the NL, I firmly believe, have lapped them, you know, quite well. Even the Mets, for goodness sakes. But then I talk about there's some fresh faces in the organization, which we'll talk about later. And I still think there's enough veteran presence buoyed by some youth to kind of make things interesting. So these are the things I juggle with, and I want to know what you might juggle with.
Well, what I juggle with is this. Okay, and here I go.
And
because
go.
Because you can't predict the Pirates the way you can a normal sports franchise, meaning one that takes itself seriously. Okay. Because the Pirates don't ever enter a season with all guns loaded. What they do, and they actually will, in their own way, acknowledge this. What they do is they enter a season with kind of what they want and some crossed fingers, and then they'll kind of see how it goes. So they see how it goes. They get to around May or June, and Neil Huntington will start saying things like, well, we're trying to evaluate whether we add or, you know, whether we're buyers or sellers. And, you know, and then he'll remind everybody that they were buyers all 3 years in 2013 to 15, which they were. And they kind of just sit back and wait and see how it goes. And how do you predict how that's going to go? Do you see what I'm saying? Because you get to June or July, and let's say a bunch of things went wrong, okay? What are they going to do from there? They're not going to blow it up completely, but they're going to move, you know, a Francisco Cervelli. They're going to move maybe a couple other expensive guys. And then all of a sudden you're talking about, instead of, you know, a base prediction for the team would be 82, 83 wins, something in that range, like mm-hmm. last year. Mm-hmm. But then now you're talking about 70. Now, if things go really well and they add, I mean, they'll probably add too late, but you could be talking about something a little bit better, which is one of my foundational criticisms of this franchise is that they don't enter a season giving themselves the best shot. And as an admittedly small example of that, what's the strength of this team?
The pitching.
Yeah, specifically the starters.
Right.
But the back end of the pen as well, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you know you have that. You know you have, I mean, at least as much as we can, forecast regarding Joe Musgrove, you know, who's maybe out of the four, the one that's the kind of the, you know, we'll see guy. You know you have four starters. You know there's a lot of respect for them around baseball, and there should be, okay? It could be a really good quartet. Why cast off Ivan Nova? What's the point? To save money.
It would sure
There's
seem
literally
that way.
Nothing else that was gained.
I said it would sure seem that way.
Yeah, there's nothing else from that deal unless you really buy into the idea that they really had to have that extra $500,000 in international signing bonus cap room. There's nothing else that happens in that transaction. There's no risk in keeping him because his contract would have been up after 2019. He's a free agent at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, minimal risk, minimal gain. Why do you move him? Why do you dump him? Bad teammate? No, they loved him. The catcher's like his best buddy. He's a good calming presence. He's another guy. And if somebody does go down in your rotation, even if it's just for a little while, Nova's a guy who's handled the innings, who's handled the pressure a lot more than being with a team like this. He could have stepped up. So you don't go into the season with your best. Do you see what I'm saying here? So how do you forecast a team like that when they're not even entering the season with what everyone, including them, I'm sure they have to know this,
mm-hmm.
would be their best option. You could say the same thing about shortstop, and I'm not going to make Jordy Mercer sound like, Ozzie Smith here or something, or prime era Troy Tulowitzki or something. But you go into the season with this wonderful pitching staff and you say, we'll see what happens at shortstop. you know what I mean? Like, as if that position, if you have a banjo hitter out there, you still need somebody to catch the ball,
Yeah, and one of my biggest major concerns here is,
my biggest concern about Eric Gonzalez isn't the fact that he couldn't hit at all in the spring. I mean, that stuff comes and goes. But fielding is fielding, and I don't like what I saw in the field either. I don't know that they have a major league shortstop right now. So as much as I want to look at them like they're some normal team and say, okay, well, here, I could look at the Milwaukee Brewers and say, I think that this team is good for this and this and this number of wins because you trust their ownership to do the right thing. You trust that they have the correct motives in mind. And you trust that they're entering the season with giving themselves the best possible chance to win the Central Division. These guys can't do that.
No, and
I know that's not answering your question, but that's actually the most honest answer that I can give.
No, it does answer my question in a way because in a way we kind of hit the nail on the head as to why we can't accurately predict this team is because they can't predict themselves. They don't.
They're sitting around waiting. Yeah, yeah. They're going to sit on their thumbs for 4 months to see whether or not they feel it's worth their time or, more importantly, their money to put something else into it instead of saying, hell, man, just keep Nova for another year. He was 8.5. He was 8.5 within a rotation that, frankly, isn't making a whole lot as a collective because of their experience level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you think
and
about
it wouldn't have hurt that the BS line from Frank Coonley about how the real reason the payroll went down is because they got to pay all these arbitration guys next year. They wouldn't have had to pay Nova.
No, sir. That would have been $8 million off the books no matter what, and probably if they are taking a budget from year to year, it would have been less because I'm absolutely sure they would have been able to dangle him for someone at the deadline. I really think that.
Oh, Nova, absolutely. Yeah, and it wouldn't have been, I mean, look, if it would have been no more or no less than whatever they got from the White Sox, which was a nothing prospect in the international signing bonus cap room. Big whoop.
Yeah.
They did it plain and simple because they prioritized cash. And that's who they are, and that's why they you have to understand, one thing about me is that I'm born and raised in Pittsburgh. I grew up on the Pirates. They were my first team. Baseball was my first love. And in being around people like Steve Blass, Manny Sanguin, Rennie Stennett, Omar Marino, guys that are lifers who've been part of championships in Pittsburgh with the Pirates, and being, I was really, really young, but at least remember the 79 World Series. It hurts like hell to see this, that this is what they've become, but this is it. You know, I know this is like, you know, I've been, you know, accused of, you know, pandering to the lowest common denominator of baseball fans or whatever else. The fact is, most of those baseball fans, the ones that just go nutting all the time, they usually get it wrong as to what's really wrong with this team. It's not just about payroll, and it's not just about being cheap. It's also about terrible drafting and developing. But the culture is so predicated on the cash aspect of it that Bob Nutting will keep you employed forever and ever and ever and ever, so long as you don't complain about the money. So it all still ends up going back there. You follow me?
Yeah, it's kind of go along to get along, and with a lot of people in the organization, I do not disagree with you there.
Very well put. Yes, very well put. And as a result, Bob Nutting, who once 10 years ago called me on his own excitedly when his plane got back from the Dominican Republic, telling me about all this potential that they have down there to build up all these prospects, and he was so fired up. I remember exactly where I was. I was in St. Louis, upper level of Busch Stadium, heading to the press box. And I heard in his voice this genuine excitement that he really wanted to do this, and he was prioritizing the amateur level, and this is what we're going to build from. And then what happens, and I stuck up for him back then because I believed in it. 5 or 6 years pass, the drafting and the developing is just a disaster, and Nutting takes no action. He doesn't do anything. He just, whatever, I have my guys in place, and that's what it is. And I ended up losing faith in him as well, which I never expected to do. But, you know, he's a big part of the problem, but not just when it comes to payroll. He could have stepped in on Miguel Sano and didn't. And I don't know how many of your listeners would be familiar with that story.
we'll save that for the we'll do a combination badminton Miguel Sano episode.
That's right. But it comes from the top, and it comes from the top with the Steelers and the Penguins as well. And I say that in the positive sense, obviously. If your heart's in the right place, if your priority's in the right place, then the same thing will apply to everybody who's underneath you.
For the masochists that are still listening, we're going to talk a little bit more directly on the field stuff right now. So I want to touch on a couple of the columns you wrote recently because they struck a chord with me. The first one is you had mentioned that in a column just this past week, I think from Houston, that some of the Pirates you've spoken to seem to have a pretty sizable chip on their collective shoulder. So my question is something like that something that can really sustain a team, help them stay competitive for an entire 162-game season?
And sustain's a good word, because I think sometimes when people read pieces like that, they go, oh, all that matters is talent. Well, yeah, of course. I mean, that's kind of a given. But once the talent starts to show, the culture and the intangibles do matter, and how you perform together and how you sacrifice for each other and how you have each other's backs and help each other out, all that stuff does matter. This is an angrier group than the ones I've covered in recent years. A lot of that is individual, and you'd have to go on a literal case-by-case basis to go over each guy to see why he might have felt slighted in some form or other, or like how he might feel that he has to prove something at some special level. I ended up focusing on Josh Bell specifically in the column the day after that. But he's hardly alone. There's a lot of guys in there who feel that way. And I think to some extent, in a general sense, in a collective sense, I think they're kind of tired of hearing about the Cubs and the Brewers and everybody, because the one division that the Pirates were good against last season was what?
It was the Central, but as I've been trying to tell people,
yeah,
it took like a very rare five-game sweep of the Brewers to kind of play into that a little bit.
Yeah, but that five-game sweep was real. They didn't just beat the Brewers. They kicked their asses. That series wasn't even interesting.
Yep, and it counted.
And they all count. And the Brewers came into Pittsburgh feeling like they had to save their season, and they ended up just dying. And it's a miracle that the Brewers bounced back as well as they did. And it actually started pretty much the moment their flight took off from Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it did. And I think we're going to see a little bit of a repeat, maybe not to the degree that we saw it in 2015, but a repeat of the Central being just an absolutely horrid division for anyone else to deal with. You mentioned Josh Bell.
It could be. I don't know. I guess some of that's going to have to – a lot of that rides on St. Louis, because I think we're kind of taking it as a given that Chicago and Milwaukee will be good.
Yeah.
And then every time anybody counts out the Cardinals, they end up looking stupid. So, you know, the Cardinals will be in there too.
Yeah, absolutely. And you had mentioned Josh Bell, and he was the other column I wanted to touch on. You know, offensively speaking for this club's run production, is it as easy as I think it is to say, you know, as Josh Bell goes, so will this team's run production? Because as much talent as there is around the diamond, talking about guys like Dickerson, Gong, Marte Polanco when he gets back, Bell is still going to be entrenched at the heart of that lineup. Those are words straight from Clint Hurdle. Is he he's seemingly like a fulcrum for how this offense will produce, and I'm just wondering if you think that's accurate.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Although, as much as Hurdle is saying that he's not going to have a quick trigger on Bell, I don't know if that's true. Mm-hmm. I just don't think you can set this team up in a way that everything rides on one player in the middle of the order, and if that player doesn't do well, that you don't at least first like drop him to seventh or sixth or seventh or something in the order, and then try something else eventually. I got some vibes in Houston that strongly suggested that his rope might not be as long as how it's currently being portrayed. Which kind of surprised me a little bit. How that works, you know, over time, yeah, Bell is an enormous part of this. I've always looked at a Pirates lineup going into a season and circled one player who has the most up or down, and said, all right, here's your variable. Here's your swing vote, if you will, you know, the purple state that can make the biggest difference in one direction or the other. And there's no question that's Bell. Because I think, you know, as you go through it, you look at Adam Frazier, he just has such a consistent, locked-in, early version Nate McClouth approach at the plate that you just love. And I saw that in Houston, too. He was just lining up and whacking them all over Minute Maid Park. It looked terrific. Marte is going to be Marte. Polanco is going to be Polanco. Jung Ho, I mean, everyone's excited about the seven spring homers, but a lot of his underlying metrics in spring weren't all that awesome. And, you know, hitting home runs in Bradenton spring training off of double-A pitchers isn't going to get you anything. So I think he still has something to show, but he'll probably be whoever he was to some extent. And Cervelli's going to always hit the ball, and he's just a good hitting catcher. And then you have virtually nothing at 7 and 8, at least for the time being. So it's not a great lineup. You know, they should be able to hit to some extent, but then, you know, I don't see any huge upside unless it's Bell.
And, you know, from your column, you had mentioned a couple of mechanical adjustments that he was doing. But how much of his, I don't want to say step forward because that's such a cliche, but if he is going to be counted on to, you know, be that pendulum in the offense, is he ready for it in terms of approach, you know, mentality, and in your opinion, having spent some time with him this spring?
Well, the best thing that he can do is to have absolutely no adjustments. That's been the biggest problem with him is that his front foot, especially when he's batting left-handed, as Rick Eckstein was explaining to me in excruciating detail, I might add, down in Houston, his front foot was basically landing all over the place. And as a result, he wasn't able to put himself into anything remotely resembling a consistent launch position. Every batter, no matter who you are, has a launch position, standard launch position. And if that's constantly varying because you're trying to do different things or you're trying to get creative and go oppo, that's fine if you're Corey Dickerson. It's not fine if you're Josh Bell and you're trying to and you need to put the ball over the fence, which is why I found it kind of striking why in a conversation that we had, Bell kept referring repeatedly to, I need to do what the team needs from me. He kept saying that, what the team needs from me. Baseball players discussing home runs is a lot like hockey players discussing fighting. It's kind of like verboten. So, you know, because you're never supposed to be swinging for home runs. Like, that's just right. An uncool thing. But in this case, everybody knows what he means. You know, I mean, he's not a 50 doubles guy. He can get more doubles than he did last year. But he's a guy that when he puts it in the air, it's going to go. It's been doing that for him since he was a child in Texas. He had light power. And he's capable of doing that on a regular basis if he stays within himself. I don't know that he's going to do that. I just don't. And unfortunately, as I'm speaking to you, I am unduly influenced by my eyes watching these two games that I saw in Houston. And I probably shouldn't be, because it's just two games and a handful of at bats.
Right.
But they were not impressive. So I probably should just shut up before I unduly influence anybody else on it. But at the moment I reserve the right to be skeptical after those two completely unimportant days in Houston.
Understood. So skipping ahead a little bit, we talked a little bit earlier about how many would think that the strength of this team is going to be pitching, both starting rotation and bullpen. But with bullpens being so volatile year over year, and you know one year's shutdown bullpen is next year's leaky faucet, is that faith that we're putting in the bullpen? I don't want to say blindly, because obviously some of these guys have really established track records, but is that faith justified at this point?
Yeah, I'm not as much of a believer. I've seen the studies on the bullpen stinks one year and it's great the next year and nobody knows, and that's why nobody ever gives relievers multi-year contracts and everything. And I've heard a lot of that from Neil himself over the years. I don't look at Felipe Vázquez since he's been in Pittsburgh and say, now there's a roller coaster up and down kind of reliever. You know, mm-hmm. Never know what you're going to get from him. He's had a couple of small rough patches, but otherwise he's been exactly what he is. Kyle Crick, I think, has matured significantly since coming over, since the trade. He did not have a good spring. He also does not sound even remotely concerned about that, and explained to me why that was. Richard Rodriguez, all he's done is strike people out in the major leagues. And, Keone Kella, I mean, again, he had just a he had a couple of spring outings that were really questionable, especially the one the other day in Houston, where he was walking a lot of guys and throwing away from them. But I don't think anybody would doubt that this is someone who, when he was in Texas and then again when he came over to the Pirates, has closer pedigree, and he's only 25 years old. So I don't look at this bullpen the way that I would your standard cliched bullpen that's going to look good or bad one year to the next. And a lot of those guys that fit those cliches are usually in the 30 to 31 age group. This isn't that group. This is still a young bullpen that I think has room to get better.
I tend to agree. I think the volatility is a little muted in the Pirates' case, but very slightly. And there could be for various reasons, like you mentioned. But I want to get you out on this one. So the analyst in me hates this question because I can't tangibly quantify it yet. But from your educated observer perspective and having been with the team a little bit this spring, how much impact can the new voices, and by those I mean the Ecksteins and the return of Jeff Banister in particular, how much can those new voices really, how much of an impact can those new voices have on the 2019 club, in your opinion?
Well, Banny's not going to be around the team all that much. He's got a role where he's going to be moving around and doing a lot of different things, more as a special assistant. Now, he was wearing a uniform in Houston. He's going to be wearing a uniform at times in the season. He's going to be standing right next to Clint Hurdle at times in the season, Clint was telling me on Monday. But I don't think he's going to be that guy that's going to have that much of a voice with it. Ecksteins obviously will, being out there every day as a hitting coach. Although Ecksteins and Jacob Cruz have been inseparable. You can't even have one player. You can't have a player mention one coach without the other in the same breath. So it's more of a tag team with the hitting coaches. So, yeah, they can have an impact. There's no question, especially considering it's a younger group. They're going to be more impressionable, and they're going to hit some lows where they need some help out of them.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. And I've talked to Jacob a little bit back and forth since he got hired. And, I love the enthusiasm in particular. And is it cliche or et cetera to think that, maybe just enthusiasm for the craft is really going to put some of these guys on the path towards, professional approach to their craft?
I mean, we'll see. That ultimately has to come from the player. Yeah, I think that coaching in general can be overrated in sports. Ultimately, especially when it comes to motivation, if you're not self-motivated, you got no chance. You shouldn't even be at the top level.
Yeah, I think that's about it. So I kept you longer than I wanted to. You're gearing up to cover opening day tomorrow in Cincinnati, so please guys, please try DKPittsburghSports.com. It's 99 cents the first month, and I guarantee you, you'll be hooked on our baseball coverage after that. So, Dayon, thanks very much for joining me today.
All right, Jason. Thank you.
Okay, that was Dayon Kovacevic of DKPittsburghSports.com. Again, I'll be writing there every Monday with a column called Monday Mound Visit. It's going to be an analytical piece in nature, really leaving some room to breathe. Some weeks it might be focused on a specific topic. Some weeks it might be quick hitting on a few different other topics. So I encourage you to check it out. Again, 99 cents to try it for a month and see if you like it, see if it's for you. Now we're going to get back into the Up and Running hotline. And before I get started, I want to talk about Up and Running. So, hey, if you live in Fox Chapel, maybe Oakmont, and you're training for the Pittsburgh Marathon or Half Marathon, you want to go to Up and Running. It's the destination for marathoners and running enthusiasts. Right now you can join their group runs to help you get ready for those races, or let's say you're in Cranberry Butler and just aren't sure if you're wearing the right running or walking shoe. You can go to Up and Running to get professionally fitted. And here's why they're a professional. They were founded by a Brooks Hansen runner and his dad quite some time ago, and they have serviced the local runner and walker for 12 years. You can visit their stores in North Pittsburgh on Route 8 or in Ebensburg near Route 22, 219, and 422, or online at runpa.com. Our first text on the Up and Running hotline comes from Fred. And he asks, where would you bat gong in the lineup right now? I say closer to fourth than seventh. Well, it's easy to get seduced by the power he showed in spring training. But for me, I'm still a little bit leery of those strikeout totals, even though a ton of those weren't against what you would call quality MLB-level pitchers. So at least to start the season, I would keep him at seventh, possibly sixth, depending on matchups. Against a fastball-heavy pitcher, I might be tempted to move him up a little bit, but I also really would not want to disturb what I think would be a good 1-5 no matter what. And by that, I mean it's pretty much set in stone now, right? Frazier, Marte, Dickerson, Bell, Cervelli. Although there is some interchangeability, I think, there with between him and Lonnie Chisenhall / Melky Cabrera. We need to come up with a name for that unit, Chisenhall and Melky, so we can kind of call them the same thing. What about Chisenbrera? We'll workshop it. Even though they can kind of interchange gong with Chisenberry or Chisenbrera, sorry, I told you we're workshopping it. If gong can prove that the strikeout totals were simply him getting his footing, I would be tempted to put him fifth. Now remember, We're talking about someone who is right on the accepted average of strikeout rate, that being 21.2% for his career. So he won't have to go far to get back to his, you know, water level, so to speak. Again, 21.2% for his career, but if he can get closer to the 2016 version of himself, where he tempered that strikeout rate with a 9.7% walk rate, the Pirates will absolutely move him up for more opportunities if he can draw the walks to go along with the strikeouts. Our next text is from Eric, and he asks, is Adam Frazier going to play every day? In 159 plate appearances versus lefties, his WRC plus is only 80. So I really think Adam Frazier is going to be given the opportunity to sink or swim against left-handers for pretty much the entire season to start with. The changes he made when he came up from AAA were a little bit platoon-proof for me. Having said that, the proof is in the pudding, and he did struggle from August 1st onward against left-handed pitchers last season. 220 batting average with 10 strikeouts and 51 plate appearances. Yet, I still think he will get everyday opportunities. Pittsburgh does have Kevin Newman taking reps at second base, which he has taken throughout his minor league career as well. And Newman in particular had very good splits in AAA against left-handers. Last season slashed 336, 383, 483 in 143 plate appearances. So that was just last season. That's roughly the same amount of PAs in the majors that Frazier has had. But yeah, that's in AAA. And Newman hasn't exactly shown that anything he's done at the major league level is going to translate to similar numbers that he had in AAA. But yes, the platoon is there if need be. You know, if you look at Frazier's batted ball in particular against left-handers, in those 51 PAs, he had a 45% hard hit rate, which is good, but a 1.4 ground ball to fly ball ratio. So if he can work to lift a few more balls while still making pretty good contact, he might put those lefty woes behind him, or at least produce enough to keep him in the lineup against them. Next up, we're going to have a voicemail from Riley. Here we go.
Hey, this is Riley, and I had a question about just upcoming season, and actually more than just the upcoming season. I was wondering, considering how strong NL Central looks this year with the Pirates, Reds, Cubs, Cardinals, and Brewers all looking like, you know, decently good teams, is there any chance that there might be division realignment in the future for the MLB? Considering the AL Central is generally weak, the Twins are really the only other team that are maybe good, other than the Indians, of course. And, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of division imbalance, especially when you see all these NL Central teams just really, like, I mean, obviously not good, all like good, but decent enough where you wouldn't be surprised if they made the playoffs. So I was wondering if you ever see that maybe possibly happening in the future where the MLB shakes up divisions. Thanks.
That's a very interesting question, Riley, and thanks for sending in a voicemail. I really appreciate it. So on the surface, it makes a lot of sense. The Pirates have some natural quote-unquote rivals, although I don't necessarily agree with all of them, the Detroit Tigers being one, supposedly, as well as the Cleveland Indians in terms of proximity. Then you have the Phillies as well. But they also have ties to the old National League East with the Braves, again, the Phillies, and the Mets at times as well. So I think that MLB is the MLB and the MLBPA are a couple of entities that can't get together and decide on hardly anything together, much less realignment. I think it might be a priority in a couple of years, but the initiatives are underway now, such as what to do with the DH, how to speed the game up, reliever rules, roster rules, all that kind of crap you've heard this year. Those are far more pressing issues for MLB than divisional realignment. I can't tell you the teams like, you know, the Angels, the Dodgers, and especially the Mariners might be a little more interested in regional realignment as well, just so they can kind of avoid some of these long road trips and kind of make things look better from a logistical standpoint. But, you know, all in all, I think that it won't be the lack of competitiveness that will spur MLB into action. If lack of competitiveness was one of their concerns, you would have seen a lot more changes a lot sooner than what we're talking about today. So if it does happen, it'll be for logistical purposes and perhaps some historical purposes as well. I wouldn't mind seeing it, but I wouldn't hold your breath either. Back to the text, this one from Adam, who has two questions. We'll tackle the quick one first. The Marlins DFA Dan Straley, should the Pirates make a move for him? Also, why is Dallas Keuchel not signed yet? So quickie answer here. For Straley, there's absolutely nothing in his history that shows he is going to be enough of a better option over Jordan Lyles or even Steven Brault at this point to sign him this late in the game. As for Keuchel, yeah, he would look very good in a Pirates uniform, but the simple truth is that he will not take a one-year deal. He's sticking to it, guys. He's sticking to his guns. He's not going to budge, even though the market is saying to him, take a one-year deal. So that does not mean that the Pirates are necessarily interested in Keuchel on a one-year deal, but that kind of shows you the temperature we're dealing with in terms of his market. And if the Pirates are certainly not going to commit multi-years to him, that's for sure. So it would take something drastic for the Pirates to even go any steps further with Keuchel. Adam's other question, should we be worried about Kella and Crick's spring training struggles? They both had an ERA over 8 this spring. You know, relievers are inherently volatile, as we talked about with Dayon earlier. But in the case of Crick and Kella, I would not worry too much. Both make their living off what I would call feel pitches, those being Crick's slider and Kella's nasty curveball. So think of spring training for those two guys in particular, as well as others, as a time to lock those pitches in. In that light, their ERA should not worry you in the slightest, especially considering how oftentimes pitchers will go into games in spring training with instructions to work on one certain thing. Pitches that are thrown in spring training in certain situations or certain counts will not even be thought of in the games that counted. So take everything with a huge grain of salt, if not a full-size salt lick. That might be a better idea. Each of these guys have track records. Each will be fine. Our last text comes from Lauren, and she asks, I see other teams riding or dying with their young talent. The White Sox with Eloy Jimenez, the Padres with Fernando Tatis, the Mets today with Peter Alonso. Why can't the Pirates do that? Why? With a few exclamation points and question marks. Well, let's make one thing clear that Alonso, the Mets prospect who is a consensus top 50 in all of Prospectville, was brought up as a necessity after injuries. Guys like, I'm sorry, the names escape me right now. But your point is still well taken. I still think we have to look at the individual scenarios here because there are some baseball cases you can make for those two names you mentioned. The Padres, for example, are going to be capitalizing on the fan excitement regarding Machado, and they're going to push their chips all in, right? All in to continue to reinvigorate that fan base. And you might want to have Tatis playing along Machado. Might help speed up his development a little bit. The White Sox just paid Eloy Jimenez a nice chunk of guaranteed change on an extension, so they too might want to just get the ball rolling and get MLB reps for their best prospect now so they get the most out of their contract later. They're not going to pay someone that much money to sit in the minor leagues and eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So taking it back to the Pirates' perspective, we're really only talking about one guy this year at least, and that's Ke'Bryan Hayes. No doubt he is probably ready, but the club already has a slugger at that position in Gong who can't play anywhere else with regularity, in my opinion. The team was arguably close to contending for the second wild card spot last year until an August slump. So it makes more sense to me to roll the dice on Gong at a bargain rate and potentially get into that wild card race rather than force Hayes into action and possibly stunt his development, because let's remember, he needs some AAA at-bats. He really does. If he's not going to come up and play regularly, which he won't, what's the point? So at least right now for this year, that's the example that you'd be referring to. And you know, many times the Pirates, like many, many, many teams, should be criticized for service time manipulation. But this particular year may not be a good example of that. So that brings us to the end of this episode of the BuckleCast, episode 10. Thank you guys very much for supporting the show, for subscribing. If you're not subscribed, please do so. It's the best way to get our show. You'll get all the episodes automatically as they are released. The best way you can help our show as well is to tell a friend. You know, if you enjoy the show, share it on Twitter, share it on Facebook, write it down in a letter, send it to your best buddy, your best pen pal. You know, tell the neighbor across the street about it. Anything like that helps, and we really appreciate it. Now that we're in the regular season, you know, this podcast may shift a little bit. It's still going to be a weekly show, but I'm toying with the idea of maybe adding a very quick mini show, talking 5 or 10 minutes to release on Mondays, that will just be like a table setter for the week. We'll tell you the pitching matchups as they are scheduled, anything to look for in the Pirates' upcoming opponents. So a nice little companion piece to my Monday Mound Visits piece that will be up every week, every Monday on DKPittsburghSports.com. I'm toying with that idea, so please let me know on Twitter if you think it's a good one. You can find me on Twitter at JRollisonPGH. That's JRollisonPGH. You know, when I spell my name for people, I kind of say roll is on, but no one really gets it. So I don't know where I'm going with that. But anyway, I thought it was cool. So, you know, this podcast will definitely change as the season goes on. Always open to new ideas and suggestions, so please leave a review or tell me on Twitter. You can also shoot me an email at jrollison@gmail.com. So, once again, thank you for listening to the BuckleCast, and we'll talk to you next week.